We've been forced to face a cold reality in recent years that there are a lot of racists. Even if they would never identify themselves as racists, they carry around beliefs that this group of people commits more crimes or that group of people is better at banking or math or music or whatever. Our guest this hour knows the human genome well, and he wrote a book that he explicitly intends to be used as a weapon. Adam Rutherford is the author of How to Argue with a Racist, What Our Genes Do and Don't Say About Human Difference. Adam Rutherford got a PhD in genetics and then hung up the phone. Turned his attention to communicating science to the world. He writes for the science pages of The Guardian and writes and presents science programs for the BBC on radio and TV. His previous books include A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived. We reran that interview just 6 weeks ago, so we're glad to be having Adam Rutherford back on the program. Again, he does intend for this to be used as a weapon because it provides conclusive evidence, as if any more were needed, of the fact that human beings are a race, a human race, and there are no other genetic markers that indicate that there are different kinds of races. Adam Rutherford, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Hi, Jeff. Good to speak to you again.
Indeed. Well, you got a recent refresher then on you telling us that humans do not have that many ancestors. That's one of the more interesting points to carry forward from that book to this.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So just the whole notion of us having two parents and everyone having two parents and four grandparents and eight great grandparents should tell us that our family trees expand exponentially as we go back through time. But we also know that that the population of the Earth is greater than it has been at any time in history. So that sounds like a conundrum. But actually what happens is our family trees collapse in on themselves after only a generations, and it turns out that we're all descended from the same population, the entire same population, only a few thousand years ago. We're incredibly inbred as a species, not dangerously so, but just the number of our ancestors is very small.
So that alone should indicate the idea of racial purity or pure bloodlines or whatever you want to attach to pure is really not something that's possible.
That's right. The idea of racial purity or bloodlines is just myth, and it plays to the, you know, a very human characteristic, which is narrative, that we want narrative satisfaction and we want to be able to position ourselves in this, you know, this giant mess that we're in. And one of the ways that we do that is by identifying the concepts of bloodlines, looking back to our ancestry and saying, you know, I'm descended from these people, or I can trace my ancestry to, I don't know, the Pilgrim Fathers if you're in the States, or Native American ancestry. But the truth is that everyone is descended from the same population. Just like even a few centuries ago, the whole population of Europe is the ancestor of the current population of Europe. And so what we now know from genomics is that every American has African ancestry and indigenous American ancestry, as well as European ancestry. And I can say that with absolute confidence, including African Americans who have European ancestry and indigenous Americans who have both European and African ancestry, and for all European Americans who also have African American ancestry and indigenous American ancestry. And I know it sounds crazy, and it sounds like I'm, you know, being sort of obtusely politically correct or woke, but that's just I'm just reporting the facts. This is what we know from genealogy, from genetic genealogy, and now from looking at our genomes, which we can do with more ease than at any other time in history.
So now to the opposite of woke, Adam. How much did the racism of recent years figure in the birth of this book?
Well, it's a funny thing now, because, you know, the book that I've been on this program talking about a couple of years ago, A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived, contains a chapter on race and also eugenics, which is related to race but different, a separate idea. And I talking with my editors, and we felt that there was a sort of emergence over the 3 years it took me to write that book, that the conversation was changing. Here in the UK, we had Brexit. In the States, we had President Trump. And it meant that the rise of these sort of populist ideas were making race part of the discourse again. Now, you know, the history of race in America is very different from Europe for obvious reasons, for reasons that I don't need to explain. And then, you know, the book came out in the UK in February. And then COVID happened, and then George Floyd was killed, and the Black Lives Matter protests and kicked off. And that, you know, all of a sudden, this book that I've been sort of stewing over and writing for many years suddenly became, you know, wow, this is like more relevant than ever. So, you know, I'm glad it's out now. I don't feel celebratory about the fact that it needs to exist, because what I really care about is, you know, genetics and evolution and science. But it sort of needs to exist, because what we're seeing is the co-opting of science, the marshalling of science into justifying racist ideologies, and that is what I'm not okay with. You know, you can't have my tools to justify your bigotry.
And what kinds of names have people called you in objection to your writing about race?
Well, that's a hell of a question. Well, I'm mixed race myself. So my mother was born in Guyana, but is of Indian heritage, so descended from indentured people, which is a form of slavery under the British rule there. But I wasn't raised by her, so my parentage is actually just white British, and I culturally I am white British, but I'm darker skinned. So throughout my life, I've not experienced a great deal of racism, although personally directed at me. But there's been enough to start those fires. But as an adult, as a geneticist for the last 20 odd years, and talking about race in public, and especially with the rise of social media, there's a range of insults that I get on a daily basis. Sometimes I get accused of being a racist myself. I never quite have understood that. Recently, I was accused of being anti-Semitic, which is all similarly baffling. The most common one is one that we alluded to a minute ago, which is that actually, this is just political correctness, this is just wokeness, that actually, you know, I'm betraying science because I'm denying the reality of the biological definition of race. The phrase I use in the book that is being leveled at me is that I'm sacrificing scientific truth at the altar of political correctness, which is a hell of a phrase. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I go to great lengths in the book to say, well, two things. You know, as a scientist, you have to be guided by the data, right? And that's a really core principle, and not be guided by your political views that you then use to justify, you know, interpretation of the data. That's a really important point. So I go to great lengths in the book to explain why I'm arguing the case against the biological reality of race, and sort of going unpicking all of those myths and stereotypes that non-racists have, that people who aren't, you know, white supremacists or neo-Nazis, but also actually harbor views about race which are sort of rooted in science but are actually untrue. But at the same time, I think it's really important that scientists acknowledge that science is done by people, and the data is never neutral. Science is as structurally racist as any part of society, because science is part of society. And it's really important that we acknowledge that within science. I have reached these conclusions that I talk about in the book about race and genetics predominantly because of the science, because of my study of human evolution and genetics over the last 25 years. But I would be in denial to say that it's not also informed by my political views, because scientists and I and you and everyone listening is part of society, and we can't separate out those things. I don't think it's good enough to say, you know, the data is neutral and it's just your interpretation of it that makes it politicized. I do not think that's true, and I argue against that in the book. So I want to be really upfront about what the data says and how we interpret it, but also that scientists are people and come with all of the baggage of, you know, 300 years of a science that is actually based on racism. That is where biology started.
Really? Okay. So, let's get to that point, because you just said that people had carried beliefs that are rooted in science but actually not true. You say in the book that science and racism are inherently entwined, and it seems like the more we learned, the more we assumed we knew what things meant and often ended up wrong.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I think this is why the history of this subject is really important. The history of biology is something I've written about a lot, and it's very shallow. You know, if you compare it to the history of, like, physics, well, the ancient Greeks, the Babylonians were looking at the planets, but we've only sort of robustly begun to study biology, and particularly human biology, in the last 300 years or so. And it's very much associated with men in England and in Europe, particularly when looking at humans, as we experience them as colonialization is occurring, as European expansionism is happening in the era of us, I say us meaning Europeans, are traveling to other countries, taking them over, and part of the sort of side branch of this European expansion empire building project is that we begin to encounter people from the rest of the world, and men in London, in Germany, and in and around northwestern Europe then begin this project of categorizing people, of taxonomy, classifying people as we encounter them. Now, I'm going to use some language here, which are sort of touchstones today, but I'm going to use them in a slightly different way, because the classification of people that occurs at this time by people like Linnaeus and Kant and Voltaire, you know, founding fathers of Western philosophy, who are also profoundly racist people, the classification that occurs is not simply classification as in just sort of neutrally trying to describe how people are or how an organism is. They are inherently hierarchical. In every single case, they are hierarchical. And, you know, see if you can guess who comes top of that hierarchy. It's white Europeans. So this is the marshalling of science, or pseudoscience as we now know, and this is done predominantly by skin color. Pigmentation is the primary concern of these original documents from the 17th, 18th century. This is the marshalling of a pseudoscience in order to justify a political ideology. So in that sense, it is the opposite of science, right? It is creating data, you know, false data, in order that we can justify the subjugation of people. And so the roots of science, the Linnaean system of taxonomy, we still use that today, right? That is genus and species, Homo sapiens. And so the roots of my subject are inherently entwined with European expansionism and the era that becomes the transatlantic slave trade. It is the denial of reality to say that science is neutral in this regard. Science was constructed in order to justify the subjugation of people, and that's just historically honest. The trajectory of science is wonderful because it goes from there into the. By the time we get to the end of the 20th century, and now with the age of genomics, we can say race, as we colloquially use it, the folk definitions of race, are simply not reinforced by our current understanding, our contemporary understanding of human genetics. Race is a social phenomenon, not a biological one.
Adam Rutherford is our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange. His latest book is How to Argue with a Racist, What Our Genes Do and Don't Say About Human Difference. You are welcome to get into the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And Adam, you really make this plain. People moved around and had sex wherever and whenever they could. I mean, on some level, we have to know there's a flaw in thinking of racial purity, don't we?
I guess so. But I mean, I come across a lot of people who don't think about it that deeply, because the stories we tell ourselves are more important sometimes than, you know, really delving into a subject that never intended to be understood. You know, evolution had no intention of us ever decoding it. The genome is written in such a way, it's a complete mess. It's a disaster when you want to actually understand it, because it had no intention of being decoded. But that is what we did. And yeah, as you say, the two things that humans are really good at is moving around and reproduction, having sex. And that is the story of humanity. And so you can apply that across tens of thousands of years, epochs, or even hundreds of thousand years, or you can do it in much smaller time frames. But the stories we tell ourselves are, well, this is my lineage, this is my family. Can trace my ancestry back through this particular branch all the way back to, you know, whoever, wherever that you reach an unscalable wall. But in doing that, you're ignoring almost all of your ancestors. Almost all of the people who you are actually descended from are not on that family tree, because most people pass through history and leave no trace, just, you know, shadows and dust. And you know, it's fair enough that humans do that, because we need to tell ourselves stories. We need to position ourselves in history. It's just that we don't tend to do it accurately. And science is there to you know, pull the sheet off and show how things really are, rather than how we present, how we perceive them. I've got a good story about that in the book, which relates to me personally, which is that when we looked at our family tree, the Rutherford family tree, which is based in the northeast of England around Newcastle and southern Scotland, we came across an ancestor of mine whose name was Mary Huntley, but on her marriage certificate it said Mary Huntley Savage, right? And which is an interesting really? Turn of phrase for the early 19th century. And then when we went back further, she was the daughter of Neil Huntley, and it turned out that Neil Huntley was a Catawba tribesman imported from America to join Handy's Traveling Circus. And Benjamin Handy was my great-great-great times five grandfather. And so, you know, super weird. You suddenly discover that this very British family has a Native American ancestor in there who's imported to join the circus, right? What a cool story. The reason I want this story in the book and the reason I tell you this is because it's cool, but it says nothing about my ancestry. Mary Huntley was probably the ancestor of maybe 1 million or 2 million people in the UK, because that's how family trees work, that they spread out, you know, so quickly. Do I carry any of her DNA? Almost certainly not. Does it inform my cultural identity? Categorically not. Is it a cool story to tell at dinner parties? Yes, it is. But what does it say about ancestry? It says that we focus on the stories rather than on the reality.
Let's take a phone call here. We have Anne in Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. The importance of racism in America, and even before it was the United States, it goes about 400 years, and it's been used to justify genocide and to justify slavery. And right now, it's the main voting point for the Republican Party. And we've never had a truth and reconciliation about that history. And I don't know how we're ever going to get out of this conundrum. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. Appreciate that. So I think it seems like one of the ways to get out of it, Adam, is by talking about the stuff you bring up in the book.
Yeah, I mean, I think Anne's point is right. And I have to be cautious as a British person talking about American history, but I love America and I spend as much time there as I can. And it has this peculiar history. And I think she's spot on that America has never fully reconciled its history of racism and slavery. And I wrote a new introduction for the book for the American edition, which was written, you know, actually only about 6 weeks ago.
Yeah,
I tried to bring it right up to date with COVID and Black Lives Matters. And I was, you know, as part of that, I was looking at the history of race riots in the States, as have been happening recently, you know, in the last few months. But they happen all the time. I mean, it's been a continuous stream, and the causes of them are exactly the same every single time. And I cataloged a few of them back to, I only went as far back as 68, mm-hmm. And Martin Luther King. But, I mean, that's an astonishing thing to see, that this is not new, and this is not something that has ever been rectified. Now, you know, I'm not pretending that I'm going to fix racism with a book about science. That isn't what I do. I'm a scientist, and I'm focused on one particular aspect of structural racism, which is when it becomes used or marshaled by racists to justify the differences between people rather than celebrate them. And that's the bit that I think is really important, because when you're kitted out with that knowledge, when you know that the biology that is in the book, that is about genetics and about how families actually work and about our evolution, then I think you become in a very strong position to say, well, you know what, you can be a bigot, you can be a racist if you want, but you can't justify it using science. You can only justify it saying that this is what I feel. So that's why I think that science is an ally to anti-racists and is no ally to racists themselves.
And again, as Adam Rutherford says in the book, this book is a weapon. It is called How to Argue with a Racist, What Our Genes Do and Don't Say About Human Difference. So there is human difference, though. We've already had another contact from a listener who says, well, what about the fact that people do have darker skins, or some people have better skills at certain sports, or God forbid, you're not lactose intolerant. You know, the chugging milk thing is the one that blows my mind.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? It's just absolutely nuts that... Well, yeah, you know, like, I think it's really important, again, that we're honest about this. When people are different, of course they're different. We'd be crazy to say that they're not. I'm not a blank slatist at all. We see human difference around the world, and we try to understand it in my field, in genetics. And it's really important as well. Saying that race doesn't exist is wrong. Being colorblind is also wrong, because you're denying the experience, the lived experience of people. Race absolutely does exist. It's just that it exists as a social construction rather than a biological one. You know, if I were to say, you know what, there's no difference between African Americans and European Americans, that would be a crazy thing to say, because the lived experience of being African American, being descended from the enslaved, is an entirely different one from anything else. And you can't, it's a crazy thing to say, well, science says that there is no such thing as race, because it does exist. I don't want to go out there and, you know, deny people's reality, because that is just, you know, not correct and not useful. The sport thing, I think, is really, really important. There's a whole chapter on sport, and I love my sport, and I recognize that not everyone does. But I do think that sport is an important part of this conversation, because it is how we see people performing at their extreme abilities from around the world. And there is enormous racial disparity within sports. And so often people who are not racists hold views about sporting success in particular domains, which are racialized. So, you know, obviously 80% of people in the NBA are of African-American descent. And that's been pretty consistent since the 1970s. There hasn't been a white person in the final of the 100 meters since 1980, and that was a year when America boycotted because it was in Moscow. And so you see these data sets and say, well, you know, surely that does say something about the ancestral origins of these people in elite positions in sport. Now, it does, and there is a biological basis to success in sports. And we don't have time to get stuck into the reads here about this. It's all in the book. But the truth of the matter is that those biological advantages that certain people have, which pushes them, which is the basis of them being elite sports people, they exist. Are they unique to specific racial categories? No, they are not. Absolutely, they are not. The genetic component, which we think is a necessary but not sufficient contributor to being a sprint athlete or good at explosive energy sports, exists at a high frequency, a higher frequency in African Americans than it does in European Americans. But the difference is like 10%, 10 to 15%, which goes no way to account for the fact that there hasn't been a white person in the sprint for 40 years. And the opposite in swimming, which is that there's only been two African-Americans in the history of the Olympics in swimming competitions. Now, that is one particular thing that actually drives me nuts, and I get quite angry about this, because many African-Americans do not swim, and there have been many attempts to biologize the reason for this by saying something about their bones being denser, which is just... there's a tiny of that sort of underwrites that sort of thing, which is to do with osteoporosis, but it's really just fundamentally just hokey nonsense. The real reasons why African Americans don't swim are all socioeconomic. There are no role models. The swimming pools were built even after segregation in predominantly white areas. It has an economic cost, because swim lessons tend to be extracurricular. Right, you know, there's the top five reasons that were listed by Swim America a few years ago, all of them socioeconomic, none of them biological. And the reason it makes me angry, this, is because, well, a lot of African Americans and black people here believe the myth of bone density and buoyancy, when actually it's just complete nonsense. And the death rate from drowning for African American children in America between the ages of 8 and 14 is 3 times higher than it is for European American or white Americans. So this is a type of structural racism which is literally lethal. And it's sort of heartbreaking that can exist in the 21st century in such an obvious way. And then people just still try to find biological differences in order to justify the fact that fewer African Americans swim. And it is literally lethal.
And the book is packed with facts. It is called How to Argue with a Racist, What Our Genes Do and Don't Say About Human Difference. And as we pointed out, Adam wrote a very recent preface for the American edition that includes the aftermath of George Floyd and the pandemic. So lots of new stuff in there. Adam Rutherford, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
You too, Jeff. I'll speak to you for the next one.
All right, take care.